Welcome to the Educause podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the Educause 2008 annual conference. Participants include Rob Garfield, educational technologist at Columbia University. This session is entitled The Global Classroom, Integrated Approaches to Sustainable Development Practice.
Okay, thank you. Can everyone hear okay in the back? Very good. Okay, my name is Michael DeBlasi. I'm with Seattle University, and I'm the session convener for today. And I'd like to welcome Rob Garfield from Columbia, who's going to speak about the Global Classroom, Integrated Approaches to Sustainable Development Practice. We do also have some special guests today in the room. We have Susan with a group from Korea that is here attending Educause, and we want to welcome them. They are going to be doing some translation during the program, so if you just be wary of that, that's for them to be able to get the most out of this presentation here, so we do welcome them. Okay. Again, I will say what you've heard in the other presentations. We do encourage your online feedback after this. All the terminals out there are set to the Educause site, and it's very easy to do the feedback of the presentation, and that's really important for us to hear what your needs are and be able to improve things in the future. So if you would do that, that would really be appreciated. And we will make sure the session ends on time so you can get to your next session. Okay, so thank you very much, and let me introduce Rob.
Thank you very much, Michael. Can you all hear me? If you can't hear me, raise your hand. That's a joke. Okay. Actually, I do want a show of hands for a lot of you here present, I'm sure, in your daily jobs. And how many of you get even the slightest bit nervous before giving a presentation? Just a show of hands.
We get a cup slot after lunch.
Come on, don't be shy. Well, for everybody who raised their hand, I really want to thank you all for coming in your underwear today. Solidarity. Okay, hold on a sec. This is a curse of being tall. It affects me in airplanes as well. Okay, first off, before I start talking about the Global Classroom, I'd like to tell you where I come from and who the players are in the creation of this unique course. First off, as Michael said, I come from Columbia University. The department that I work in at Columbia is called the Columbia Center for New Media Teaching and Learning. That's CCNMTL. And I want every single one of you to say that 10 times fast now. Okay, two is fine. Okay, the Center for New Media Teaching and Learning was founded in 1999. A professor from Teachers College at Columbia, Frank Moretti, got together with the head of academic computing at Columbia, and they decided that they wanted to form an organization that would advance the purposeful use of technology in the classroom. The idea and the key word in that sentence is purposeful. We are interested in using technology educationally, but we stress pedagogy over the technology. If we encounter a situation where we feel like a classroom solution can be achieved without introducing technology just as well, we will tend to go with that option because, as we all know, introducing new technologies into the classroom comes with its own pitfalls. So we weigh situations and we try to come up with a solution where, if we do introduce the technology, the pitfalls will be outweighed by the benefits. I'm going to quote a few numbers, and I'm not sure exactly how our marketing group came up with them, so take them with some grain of salt. But we have worked with faculty around 3,000 faculty, which seems high to me, but it does indicate that we do work with a lot of faculty in the Columbia community, as well as some outside. Our primary goal is to actually improve education at Columbia, but we do have some projects, as I mentioned, that reach outside the bounds of Columbia, the Global Classroom being one of them. We've done over 200 projects with faculty at Columbia and outside. And as I said, we've been around since 1999, and our group is now about 45 strong, and we're interviewing a few more people. So we'll be 47 probably within a month. So as far as educational technology groups go, we're pretty much a success story, at least at this point. You never know what can happen. For this project, we also worked with the Earth Institute at Columbia. Who here has heard of the Earth Institute? Okay, so a few of you, but not a whole lot. The Earth Institute is one of the centers in the world for sustainable development theory, education, and practice. The head of the Earth Institute is Jeffrey Sachs. And let me see a show of hands for Jeffrey Sachs. Actually, a few more, surprisingly. So they were our main clients in this endeavor. At the Earth Institute, Jeffrey Sachs and another man named John MacArthur put together a commission for the education of international development practitioners. And that is another set of people that formed our client base. It was 13 people, including Jeffrey Sachs and John MacArthur, but also including people like R.K. Pachauri, who is a Nobel Peace Laureate for his work in climate change, and as well as a number of other important figures around the world, Jim Kim, Lee Chong. So we started out with a fairly global base of experts to work with. And before I start actually talking about the Global Classroom itself, I want to say that I consider this session a dialogue. So if you guys at any point have questions, please raise your hand. And if I'm not in the middle of the sentence, and sometimes when I actually am in the middle of a sentence, I will do my best to answer it. Making a good talk involves the energy from the crowd as well as my own energy up here. So I hope that you consider yourselves part of this and will jump in at any point to clarify things or ask questions. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so I told you a little bit about the Commission on Education for Sustainable Development Practice. The Commission was put together in order to identify needs in sustainable development education. Sustainable development, as you guys, many of you probably know, is an inherently multidisciplinary discipline. It's a sort of meta-discipline. It brings together a lot of different sub-disciplines from four main areas: natural sciences, health sciences, social science, and management. And that when the Commission came together, they realized that there was sort of a lack in the field of development practice around the world. They identified a certain type of practitioner that they didn't feel existed, or existed sort of in a vacuum. People who were on the ground, who were actually practicing development around the world, who didn't talk to each other, who didn't have any kind of standards by which they practiced. And there were issues with that. So what the commission wanted to do was actually define who this person should be. A generalist who understands a lot of the key issues in the four areas that I just mentioned, as well as someone who is able to build community and share their ideas with other people around the world. So when the commission identified this person, they decided, well, why don't we come up with some kind of way to actually educate these people and standardize their education. So they came up with an idea to create a real-world example of an introductory cross-disciplinary course. That's it. This course would target development of core competencies and practical skills required of a generalist development practitioner. They also wanted to mobilize practitioners, students, and faculty from around the world. They wanted to develop a community of these people that would actually establish the standards, practice the standards, and then feed back into the community of practitioners their experiences and learning from their practice. As part of this, the commission wanted to actually facilitate real-time interaction between the students, the budding practitioners, as it were. They felt that real-time interaction was the key cornerstone to actually getting people together and getting them talking. So when the commission decided this, then people like me and some other project managers at the Earth Institute were told to make it so. So how did we actually have to make it so? Well, first off, what we were tasked to do was we were tasked to put together an actual course. So we had to understand a pedagogical model for the said course. We also had to understood that we were going to be dealing with a number of different institutions around the world who would be taking this course at the same time. They'd be taking it simultaneously. So we had to actually mobilize those partner universities. We had to develop a model that would meet the needs of the lowest common technological denominator, as well as, you know, incorporating our sort of ideal pedagogical situation. And to do that, we had to identify the best or easiest, most immediate technology that would help us do this. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to be going through these three things. Do you guys have questions at this point? Okay. Okay. So when we first started, this incredibly simple model up here we identified as our lowest common denominator. Our course curriculum was going to be composed of lectures that the commission members created, a common syllabus, other materials, readings, things like that, potentially assignments. But all of these things they form the foundation of the course. And you'll see in this, where it says tape lectures up there, we're assuming just the basic foundation of the course, which is, you know, Jim Kim, Freddie Quasiga talking about agriculture, what have you. Just make all these lectures from the commission members, these experts in sustainable development, available to our partner institutions. And it's audio and video. Yeah. And I'll get to more of the specifics in a little bit, but you'll notice that the arrows are one way here. So this is a little bit more like a conventional distance learning situation where course materials are put somewhere and made available to a group of institutions or a group of people. A slight difference is that these participating institutions, represented by these absolutely gorgeous icons down here, are conducting their own classes. So every single one of those gorgeous icons represents a class that is going on in a partner institution somewhere in the world. So this is our first lowest common denominator. Now, the arrows coming down, that could be any kind of method of delivery. This could be us putting up a CMS, setting up a CMS on the web, and institutions logging in, grabbing their material and pulling it down. This could be us, us actually sending somebody to sub-Saharan Africa with a CD. Yes?
So you're saying
that these taped lectures are simply instructional materials that can be implemented in some manner, however they choose, at whatever point? Exactly. The question was, are these taped lectures are instructional material that would be grabbed and taken by the participating institutions and used in their own local class? Did I get that right? Yeah, and that's exactly the way in this model it happens. But another question. Well, this is. At this point in the chronology of my talk, we were coming up with pedagogical models to understand how this would actually come about. Developing the curriculum was the job of the commission on the education, and all that they had at this point was the agreement to put together these lectures and make them available. And that's all they had as far as curriculum was concerned. Does that answer your question? Absolutely. Let me try to rephrase the question. You're asking how was it decided what would be in these lectures, what kind of depth these lectures would go into, and with the thought in mind that the local institutions, especially in this model, would have different needs for their local class, and how did we come up with the actual content? And the answer is that this was coming up with the actual content was a negotiation within the commission itself to identify the particular areas that they wanted to treat, then identify some expert in the world who would be willing to actually talk about said area, and then come to an understanding about what the actual class was about. It's a survey class. There's a lot covered in it, so the depth is not immense. But that's a really good question. What we ended up doing was we had a guinea pig from the commission create a lecture, record it, create it, write the readings, basically create a session, a class session, model class session, as it were. And then that class session was brought to the commission. The commission discussed the pros and cons of approaching, creating a session that way, made adjustments, and came up with a set of protocols for the lectures. Now, there's not a whole lot of limitation that you can put on these people, because one, we wanted their creativity, and two, their subject matter differed, immensely. So there were just certain elements, like you mentioned depth, and that was a big issue. We started to assume a set of students who had previously become experts in certain fields, but didn't know really anything about the others. So for some students, certain lectures were going to be, far too general. And for others, they'd be potentially eye-opening. Is there another question back there? Yes, sir. Oh, I can show you the participating institutions in a second. Actually, here we go. This is the Global Classroom website. These are the participating institutions. In Brazil, we have Universidade de São Paulo, Tsinghua, I don't want to ching it right into the microphone, UIBE in Beijing, UIDE from Ecuador, Ethiopia, Makele University, Sciences Po in France, Ghana Institute of Management and Public Administration, Terry University in India, the University of Malaya, University of Ibadan, in Singapore, the Lee Kuan Yew School, Makerere in Uganda, IDS in Sussex, England, and two U.S., actually that's expanded a little bit. This page is a little out of date. We had Columbia and Georgetown, and now we have Brandeis and Emory as well. So those are participating institutions. You guys can go to this site as well and check it out. Commission members, range from people like Ernesto Zedillo, Zhao Geng. I mentioned Jim Kim before. I mentioned Jeffrey Sachs and R.K. Pachauri, Livingstone Labubi from Makerere, John MacArthur, who's now the CEO of Millennium Promise. A number of important thinkers and practitioners in the world of sustainable development. These were the people who were charged with putting together the content of the course. Any other questions on that? I really appreciate these questions because they'll help clarify things. Okay. In our model, in our second model, and there are four of these, we added the possibility of having networked events. Networked events could be anything from live chat to a broadcast lecture we even considered the possibility of using virtual world, anything that is synchronous, a synchronous event. And what that does, adding that into the model, what that does is it actually you see at the bottom, our beautiful icons now have arrows between them, because at certain points along the way of the course occurring, the local class, all the local classes would get together and interact. And we start having a Q&A, a discussion, a global discussion. And now this is looking a little bit more like a global classroom. Are there questions on this? Like I said, in this is a model, so it's abstract. The possibilities for us were anything from live chat, just getting on it in a chat room together, to getting in Second Life together, to having a video conference. These were the possibilities that we were considering at this point. Yes. That's a great question. The question is, how do you handle the time difference in different places if you're going to have a synchronous event? So this is why this is model two, not model number one, or one of the reasons. As it turned out, when we first did a run-through of the global classroom, our westernmost institutions were Columbia and Georgetown, and our easternmost were in China. And it was started out as a 13-hour difference. So there were some sacrifices made on our end and on the far eastern end. We started Tuesday mornings around 7 in the morning, which was 8 o'clock at night. So that's how we got around it. It's still an issue. And I can talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the future going forward. Let me just move on to the much more exciting models. In model number 3, we've got the live component. We've got the research project, that's a local. Now we have a common repository and common assignments. Now this is looking a lot more like a global classroom. A local research project, and I'm sorry to use leverage as a verb, but it seems like that's accepted, and I'm a conformist, so it leverages one of the advantages of a global classroom, which is that we have institutions all over the place with all sorts of different, radically different local situations. And those are now being shared and brought into a larger conversation, as it were. The beautiful, the gorgeous icons are now joined by a much stronger arrow. And they are actually giving back work, learning, study, data, etc., to the community repository, which is shown on the bottom, the shared project repository. This was where we really felt like we would be taking off if we could achieve this. Now, before I move on to the pure genius that is Model 4, I want to say that, one of the reasons we have these layers here is because we didn't know at this point who we were actually going to have as partner institutions. We knew some of them, and some of them, those few that we knew were technologically capable of pulling off model number 3, but we also, a lot of sustainable development practice, research, evaluation goes on in sub-Saharan Africa, where there are not a lot of technological options. We knew we wanted institutions from sub-Saharan Africa to be able to participate. That was crucial for us. So we didn't know whether we were going to get there with those folks. And I don't know whether, I haven't been stressing this, but Each time I point to one of the icons, that's still a class that's going on, a local execution of a class. Now we've got all these elements that allow these classes to participate with each other. It's sort of like another layer where the class itself becomes a student in a larger class. And that's the model that we're going for. We didn't want to take the approach that there was some centralized authority somewhere that had all of the answers, and that you just sort of tapped into that authority and you pulled out that information and you dumped it into your brain. And that wasn't, for us, really the point of this. And I said that our foundation was these course materials and the participating institutions and just getting the materials to them. But really the core of the global classroom is this community of institutions working together. And in model number 3, we're starting to get there a little bit more. Questions? Because you're going to forget everything. You better ask them now, because number 4 is coming. I know. There it is. In number 4, we added these two elements. One's called trans-institutional engagement, and that's a little bit vague here. Collaborative assignments is a little bit more clear what that is. That's where you get institutions putting together papers, projects, what have you, across the world, trans-institutionally, whatever. The shared repository looks smaller, but it's actually much bigger now. In this case, trans-institutional engagement is a required element because now we need to bring not only in a live event, bring institutions together, but we need to provide facilities for them to interact and work together, the students in the local classes. They need the opportunity to do that in this case. And all of our problems, our potential problems, are still there with different levels of technological capacity, et cetera, et cetera. So, questions about this? Yes? Language difference. The question is about, what about the language difference? And that is something that I think we're going to have to definitely address in the future. We haven't, what our solution was to conduct the global classroom in English and expect that the people who were participating understood English or had a local translator. This wasn't a high budget endeavor, but it's clear that, you know, in order to level the playing field, that we're going to have to do a lot more with translation within the global, you know, interactions, things like that. The question is that there are cultural differences, within pedagogical frameworks. One point was raised that, you know, there's a potential for people to become offended. One of the buffers for that kind of thing is that students are attending a class locally. They're not being assessed globally. So there's a certain kind of buffer between their local instructor and the rest of the world. As far as somebody being offended, as far as, you know, major ideological differences coming into play, I kind of it hasn't happened in a really radical way yet, but I'm almost excited to see it happen. You know, you can't throw a punch across, you know, continents, and I don't mean to, you know, trivialize this question, but I think that that's one of the things that I, you know, like, I really hope it comes up in the global classroom, because I think it's a potentially a great learning point. And the people who are moderating live interactions, live discussions and things like that are going to be the point of contact for handling that kind of thing. And so we need our moderators to be well-versed, well-educated, and well-prepared for such an occurrence. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, the repository is bidirectional. It's actually, it's bidirectional. The thing is, you know, in this diagram, it's assumed that those participating institutions are putting in and able to access said repository as well. That was your second question. The first question was, how does Institution A decide which other institution to participate with? Well, right now we have a little bit of we have a group in place that facilitates live discussions. And those are people from the Earth Institute, project managers from the Earth Institute, as well as a sort of global moderator person, John MacArthur, right now, and a particular instance of the Global Classroom. Those people are going to be engaging in conversation with the participating institutions to decide what kinds of projects are really important locally, and then matching up institutions that want to work on similar projects. Yes. Absolutely. Model 4 has run its course. Okay, this is a bunch of words too, and maybe it's time I can show you some a little video we put together. It shows you how it kind of worked, and I can explain that a little bit more. But just as a preview for that, we used a common syllabus. We decided that order mattered. We took the lectures, we pre-taped them. We didn't make the lectures the live interaction. The lectures become another course material, another reading, as it were. And we're going to come up against, I mean, a lecture is, at the time that it's taped, a live performance frozen in time. So obviously some of these are going to become obsolete, and we have to work, you know, on moving these forward. Not all the people who gave the original lectures are going to be available to redo them. So this is a constant activity of re-updating these readings. We also have live weekly discussions. I give a little hint about that before we get together on Tuesday mornings. We're in the middle of our second Global Classroom iteration right now. The first one occurred last spring semester, starting at the end of January. And we met Tuesday mornings then as well, very early in the morning. What happens is that the particular lecture of the week, which is sort of the headstone of the module, the particular module, students are asked to view that video, respond to it in a particular way. They're given an assignment, address this lecture in some, you know, in a particular capacity, turn that in. All those assignments, those reaction papers, as it were, are assembled together by our core team that is also deciding which institutions work with each other. And then on Tuesday morning, that the person who gave that the lecture that the students viewed that week leads a discussion with the whole world in a live video conferencing situation. My grand finale is what technology we used for that, but I don't think, you know, really what technology we used for that is that important. But it is a video conference. I could show you pictures of that in a second. Let's go to the videotape.
Let me greet everybody. We are stretching across 13 hours of time zone difference. We're stretching around the world in Latin America, the United States, Europe, Africa, South Asia, East Asia. It's incredibly exciting, I must say. I believe that this is the forerunner of how education and policy making and problem solving needs to be done in our globalized world. And I think that while we're all a bit of pioneers in this today, I think we're all going to find it extremely gratifying.
One is from Babika from Sudan, and the other one is from Akila from Nigeria. Babika, you go first.
Yeah, my question, yes, we appreciate about the information you give us about African agriculture today. My question, I want to know if there any rule of international organization on tax and custom imposed by government on agricultural products?
Because the situation in Africa is still very hard, about 65% of the rural people and 25% of the urban population don't have access to clean water. Hydropower is very low in terms of the productivity. You can see that graph.
My name is Mark Bima. I'm from Sierra Leone, and I'm a budget analyst by profession. But having got this remarkable knowledge from different practitioners around the world, I'm looking at myself in the long term, maybe not only sitting in the Ministry of Finance and doing analysis, which sometimes does not directly impact on poverty. So if I want to move on into having things that directly impact poverty, using the skills I've learned here, I would like to, in the long run, what I'm thinking about is fighting poverty from within.
If you go back to Sierra Leone and there's a mining company or a palm oil company or someone else that's doing something and you approach them and say, look, you have to do a social development project, you can always count on us for backstopping you.
Okay, so the question is that was that a whole lecture or a contiguous part of a lecture? No, the answer is no. That actually shows the first bit where Jeffrey Sachs was introducing the global classroom was part of a live So I lied a little bit. We have two live events beginning the first meeting and the last meeting, two live lectures. The first piece was Jeffrey Sachs' initial lecture for the Global Classroom. And then we cut to a piece in Adobe Acrobat Connect, which was part of a normal Tuesday morning where we go around the world and students get an opportunity to ask questions, make statements, challenge, argue, discuss, things like that. And then we cut to a piece where we showed Freddie Kwasiga talking about agriculture in Africa. And that was also part of a Tuesday morning discussion. But he was able to pull up, using that technology, he was able to pull up a PowerPoint showing rainfall distribution in Africa. And then we cut to something that we do at Columbia, which is... after that hour of live discussion, the local class meets immediately on a local level. And in that session, Matthew Sandy, a student from Sierra Leone, who's actually part of the Ministry of Finance in Sierra Leone, started talking about his background and sharing his background. And I use that as an example because it's a rah-rah moment, for one. But secondly, it shows how, not only we discovered when we put this into place and we had all these institutions from around the world participating, that if we actually looked and saw who was in those classrooms as students, they were from everywhere. You know, you go to Tsinghua, there were, U.S. citizens, there were, people from Africa in the classes. Same thing with Lee Kuan Yew. So we had sort of had global, and Columbia, we had global classrooms within the global classroom itself. Yes, sir. Yeah, the question is network bandwidth in certain parts of the world is, much less available than it is in many. And what did we do to actually determine, what we could actually accomplish with our institutions or... how did we provide for really lower end groups of people? And I'm going to refer back to the initial model, and that was we thought, at the lowest common denominator, even if we were, say, dealing with a Millennium Village that didn't even have any technical infrastructure whatsoever, that somebody could go over there and give them the materials. And that's in our lowest common denominator situation. As far as us getting to a place where all of these institutions could participate and participate on an equal footing, we ended up mobilizing, gathering these partner institutions, talking to people who were interested in doing this, and then running tests with all of the software packages that we could possibly imagine. And it turned out that this video conferencing software, everybody was able to participate, some with lag. We ended up not running audio through it. We used telephone technology for that. Audio, the bandwidth that audio takes up is absurd. We were having problems within Columbia doing that through that technology. 2 minutes, okay. Sir. We used Adobe Acrobat Connect. We're totally, totally open to, better solutions than that. Okay, the question is, how much is it an issue? I'm assuming it's a language question. Yeah, people in live discussions understanding each other. And yeah, if you have a Nigerian speaking a Nigerian accent and a Chinese speaker trying to understand them, there are issues. And what we did was we had, when people asked questions, when students asked questions, we got them. We have a little chat box within Acrobat Connect, and we would get the question that they asked up on the screen in English, so that people could read it. There have been some issues with understanding speakers. And all of our sessions are recorded automatically for people to go back and listen to them. But yeah, there's still issues with that. There are issues with occasionally bad phone lines, things like that. All sorts of standard video conferencing issues as well, as the language barrier. But we do as much as we can during the live discussion to get people's statements typed up and visible. Thank you, guys. I think I got to cut it off here or they're going to hang me. So the people in black are in the back to kick me out. Just kidding. Thank you all very much.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Stream multi-format audio and video to PCs and mobile devices with Helix Server from Real. Information at realnetworks.com.